century than in all the millenniums which went before. Almost everyone knows the reason. Students of ancient history tell us that the intellect of men in those days was equal to the best of today. Yet in ancient times, material progress was painfully slow. The spirit of modern scientific inquiry, research, and invention was almost unknown. In the realm of the material, men's minds were fettered by superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. Some of the contemporaries of Columbus thought a round earth preposterous. Others came near putting Galileo to death for his astronomical heresies. We ask ourselves this: are not some of us just as biased and unreasonable about the realm of the spirit as were the ancients about the realm of the material? Even in the present century, American newspapers were afraid to print an account of the Wright brothers' first successful flight at Kitty Hawk. Had not all efforts at flight failed before? Did not Professor Langley's flying machine go to the bottom of the Potomac River? Was it not true that the best mathematical minds had proved man could never fly? Had not people said God had reserved this privilege to the birds? Only 30 years later, the conquest of the air was almost an old story, and airplane travel was in full swing. More of it. But in most fields, our generation has witnessed complete liberation of our thinking. Show any longshoreman a Sunday supplement describing a proposal to explore the moon by means of a rocket, and he'll say, "I bet they do it. Maybe not so long either." And is not our age characterized by the ease with which we discard old ideas for new, by the complete readiness with which we throw away the theory or gadget which does not work for something new which does? We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems this same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness, and we were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was.
Thank you. Liz, you want to start off?
Hi. Good morning, everybody. My name is Liz Guerrero. I am an alcoholic. And thank you, Mike, and the rest of the committee for asking me to be here today. It's a little early on the West Coast. It's 9 o'clock now, so I had to get up early and comb my hair. Many of you know Debbie D from Concord. She's my sponsor. So you know what the expectation was of how I was supposed to look when I got on this camera this morning. And I needed to be on time to listen to Wayne. Thank you, Wayne, for sharing your story. There are so many portions of your story that are different from mine, and so many things that are the same. My drinking on the outside looked very different. Let me start off with my sobriety date is February 24th, 1985. I had the blessing to celebrate 35 years this past February, right before the COVID shutdown. I had to get my 35-year chip via Zoom because we don't do fronts. And one of my home away from home group does their birthdays the last Saturday of the month. And that was 2 days after my birthday. So I skipped it. And so March, I had to get my chip via Zoom. So, but I'm grateful to be here, grateful to be sober. My home group is the Surrender to Win group in Houston, California. It's not Houston, Texas, H-U-G-H-S-O-N. I have the privilege of being the founder of that group. It's a small farm town in the Central Valley of California, and I moved there in 2010, and there was no group there when I moved there. And the closest meetings were either in Modesto or in Turlock. And I thought, this town has about 7,000 people. And so statistically, there's at least 700 alcoholics in this town. And that's much too many to not have a meeting. And then there's three other small farm towns in our area that feed into our group. That also, there's a little town called Hickman, town called Waterford, town called Keys, town called Denair, that are all right around our area. So our group is the home for all four of those little small farm towns. So one of the things that Wayne talked about was this, was having this childhood history. And I am the child of an alcoholic. My dad was a military officer, a career officer. He was, he retired when I was only 7 years old. And after a 20-year career, and the Air Force had kept his alcoholism at bay. And after he retired, he literally fell off a cliff. However, I have two sisters. I'm the oldest of three. My middle sister, Lisa, is not alcoholic. My youngest sister, Chris, is. We grew up in the same house. We had the same two parents. We were dealt the same hand of cards. And Lisa, is not alcoholic. Therefore, there's no way that I can explain away my decisions and my alcoholism on having grown up in that same house. Lisa went to high school and got good grades, got enough good grades to be able to earn her way into a four-year college. 4 years later, she had a bachelor's degree. She went to graduate school. 2 years later, she had a master's degree. Shortly after she graduated, she got a job at the University of California at Riverside. And in about 2 weeks, she's going to retire from there with 35 years in the same job. She knew how to show up on Tuesday with a paper in her hand when the professor said the paper's due on Tuesday. It might have been a B paper, but she showed up with a paper in her hand. And I could never figure out how to do that. The young lady who read just now, I think we were meant to read page 151, but fortunately she read page 51, which was great because I was going to have to go over to page 52 anyway. And it looks like I dropped off for a second.
Yeah, you want to start all over and turn your camera off and see if that will help? Sometimes when you turn your camera off, right, you get better internet.
All right. And
we'll just start all over. Give me
I'm fine. I'll just keep going. All right.
Sure.
So on that page there, it talks about these bedevilment. I was prey to misery. I couldn't form relationships. I couldn't figure out, literally, I couldn't make a living. I had this feeling of uselessness. I was full of fear. I was unhappy. Those are the same things that are on page 151. The awful awakening for the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. I'm going to raise this up again. You can see the little highlights that I've got on this from the first time I read that in 1985. And I realized that I was an unhappy drinker who read that page, and I understood. At that point, I had no idea that I was an alcoholic. I did not know I was an alcoholic. But I did know that I was an unhappy drinker, and I did know that I understood those. So I was talking a little bit about being alcoholic. My middle sister is not. My youngest sister is. I'm happy to report that my youngest sister is coming up on 21 years in recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm super grateful for that. She's married to a fellow that's got a little over 20 years. And they have a wonderful life together. My dad started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1967. I went to my first Alateen meeting in 1967. I went to lots and lots of speaker meetings. I had the privilege of hearing Chuck C. in person before he passed away, and saw Clancy and all those old time speakers in the 60s. I was very fortunate. Grew up literally around these rooms and in these rooms. And my dad finally got sober the first time after 3 years of in and out, in and out, in and out. He got sober in 1970 and he stayed sober for 8 years. And in 1978, he drank again. And then he stayed sober another 8 years. And then he drank again. And then he stayed sober another 8 years, and then he drank again. And he finally got sober to stay in 2002 when he was 82 years old. And he got sober to stay in large part thanks to Emotions Anonymous. And I'm super grateful for the people who finally, literally all those years that he struggled in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. And he finally started looking at how his emotions bedeviled him. And he found a men's group. He found some guys and played golf with them. And he finally joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And he died with 5 years of sobriety when he was 87 years old. And I'm super grateful for that. But I'm grateful for the foundation that I got even in those early years in the 60s. Because my drinking was fairly short. I drank for about 8 years. And if you do the arithmetic, I got sober in 1985. I was 27 years old. That means I'm 62 now. I'll just save you the trouble. But the first time I drank alcoholically. The way that I drank, when I drank, was the way that alcoholics drink. The first time that I remember drinking, other than like a sip of beer, like my dad would have a party or something and I would like take a sip of a beer. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the first time that I went out and sought some alcohol on my own. I was a horseback rider and I rode my horse across a railroad trestle that our town was cut in half by a freeway. And it was about 2 miles each direction to the nearest place where there was a regular car bridge. And there was a railroad trestle right in the middle. And my friend lived directly across where the railroad trestle was. So I was too lazy to ride up or down. Well, that's my first alcoholic thought right there. So I ride this horse across the railroad trestle. I don't know if you know anything about horses, but that was really stupid. If a train had come along while I was on that trestle, it would have been all bad for all of us. So I got to the other side and I got to my friend's house, never even thought about drinking. And we get there and her parents are working. And she said, they're not going to be home until like after midnight. And we opened the refrigerator and there was a bottle of Bacardi. And we decide, and I'm about 13 years old and I weigh, I don't know, about 95 pounds. We decide that drinking this bottle of Bacardi is a good idea. And so we start drinking this bottle of Bacardi. And she took one sip and I took one. And she took one sip and I took three or four. And she took one and I drank all the rest of that bottle. And when it was gone, I had to have more alcohol. And that was the first time I ever drank. And the only thing else in that lady's house, they were apparently not big drinkers, was a bottle of green cream de menthe. So I ended up the night with vomit and green cream de menthe in my hip-length strawberry blonde long hair. And I end up the night trying to wash out this vomit and green cream de menthe from my strawberry blonde hair in a sink in somebody's house. That was the very first time I drank. So if you're a drinker like me, you wake up the next morning and we think, I can't wait to do that again. A normal drinker would wake up the next morning and say, I'm never gonna do that again. And one of the things that I really like to point out is that our book is very clear in distinguishing between a heavy drinker and a problem drinker. Problem drinkers and alcoholism are synonymous in our book. Over and over, Bill refers to a problem drinker and he means an alcoholic. A heavy drinker is somebody who drinks stupid. College fraternities are filled with people who drink stupid for a season and they are not alcoholic. So just because I drink and get in trouble once or twice, the normal drinker is able to stop or moderate given sufficient reason. I was never able to do that. I use my sister Lisa as an example all the time. My sister Lisa can guarantee with 100% accuracy that a week from Tuesday, she's going to go to a dinner party given by one of her colleagues at the university where she teaches. She's going to drink 1.75 glasses of wine. She's going to leave at exactly 9:15. She's going to go home, go to sleep, wake up the next morning and go teach her class. And she can guarantee with 100% accuracy that that's what she's going to do. I cannot do that. Sometimes I might show up. I might drink two glasses of wine. I might go home at 9:15 and I might go get up and go to work the next day. And sometimes I didn't. I couldn't tell you how many times I left work and said, I'm going to go have a couple of glasses of wine with my friends after work. And I'm going to go home and cook dinner for my husband and wake up the next morning and go to work. And sometimes I did. And sometimes I didn't. Sometimes I closed the bar at 2 o'clock. And sometimes I didn't get home until 6:30 in the morning, not 6:30 in the evening. And I couldn't tell you in advance which it was going to be. That's alcoholism. I never drank alone. I never drank in the morning. I didn't drink the way my daddy did. I didn't keep bottles of gin hidden in the toilet tank. I discovered when I was a kid that you could, that's where my dad would hide them. One day the chain fell off the toilet tank lever thing. And I'm a very handy little girl. And so I pull the lid off and I'm thinking, I'm just going to reattach the chain and fix this little flapper thing. And there's a bottle of gin in the toilet tank in the downstairs bathroom. That's where dad was hiding it. And I didn't do any of those things. I had never hidden a drink because I didn't know that I was alcoholic. No one had ever confronted me on my drinking before. I'm one of those people that ran into an accelerant in the last year before my drinking. And I'm not going to get into the details of that. However, I will say that I believe that that accelerant caused me consequences that got me into the rooms of AA faster than if I had just drank my way here alone. There's no doubt in my mind that I would have drank my way into AA, but I don't know that it would have happened when I was 27. I was a bar drinker, and I don't need to go into a lot of details about what that means, but all the ladies in the room know what that is. Unlike Wayne, I was a joiner. I joined everything. At one point, I joined the Civil Air Patrol and a motorcycle gang in the same month because I wanted so desperately to be a part of anything, something. And I would join anything that would have me for a while until my behavior and my inability to form a true partnership with another human being got me to the point where I was ostracized by the people in that. And I remember when I first joined AA, I kept thinking, that's going to happen here. That's going to happen here. I've joined so many things. I joined churches and clubs and movements and everything. And after a little while, people would start to reject me and say, you know, yeah, we're having this thing on Thursday, but we're pointedly not inviting you. And I had gotten to the point at the end of my drinking where we would leave the bar at 2 o'clock in the morning and would standing in the parking lot and people would be discussing where they were going to go, whose house they were going to go to for the after party. And someone would get nominated to come over to my car and say, Liz, we're not telling you where we're going and you're not invited. We think you should go home. And that was such unbelievable humiliation at the very end of my drinking. I have a weird biochemical something quirk in that I don't black out. I drank plenty enough to black out. Don't misunderstand me. There's just something chemically weird about the way my liver operates. And that's a terrible thing. I'm here to tell you. I remember every sordid detail. I've heard so many people talk about waking up in the morning and they didn't know what they had done. And then people would tell them and they would feel this sense of shame as people described to them what they had done. I woke up in the morning and remembered firsthand with this incredible sense of shame about everything that I remembered doing. As a bar drinker, I made really, really, really bad decisions. And one of the things that I talk about is my history of marriage. The first time I was married for 29 weeks. And the second time I was married for 29 months up until the day that I got sober. Then I got married in AA and I was married for 29 years. And now I'm married to Robert, and Robert, wave your hands. And Robert and I have now been married. I checked it right before the meeting started that we've been married for 29 months and about 3 weeks. So in about 4 weeks, we will have been married for 30 months. So I'm about ready to break the record from the second one. So hopefully we'll live long enough to be married 29 years this time. I'm not sure I'll be alive that long. But that was my history of marriage. And the end of that first marriage ended up with me still married and meeting a fellow in the bar and deciding that it would be a good idea to quit my job, leave my husband, move to Utah to try out as his second wife in a polygamist family. That's the kind of thinking that led me at the very end of my drinking. And I still had 3 more years to drink and use after that. But that's the kind of thing that I was doing at that time. I'd gotten into the wine business, and I don't mean that in the funny way. Like, I really was in the wine business. I was the sommelier, and I was a member of the Orange County Wine Society. We'd moved to Orange County in about 1980, and 1982. And I'd become a member of the Orange County Wine Society, and I was studying to be a sommelier, and I was getting really good. And toward the very end of my drinking, I was entering competitions. And just a few months before I got sober, I took third place in the Southwestern United States in a sommelier's competition. And back in the 80s, this was solely a men's game. There were no women in this field at all. And so 20 people had been invited to the finals in the Bonaventure Hotel in Los Angeles. And there were 19 fellows and me. And at that time, my last name was Ripple. Like, really, I'm not joking. That was my last name, R-I-P-P-L-E. And when they announced my my third place, and the guy thought it was a K, and he said Keipel, and I was so grateful. And it was very so. But that night, after tasting these wines and triggering my alcoholism, I'm pretty sure that all the rest of the people went home. I ended up that night at a Chippendales type place, and ended up drunk on my ass, throwing up, vomiting, the usual thing. Even though I was drinking normally, or looked like it, during the time that I was allegedly working or practicing my profession, every single time I would end up the night at a bar. I would meet my mother at these meetings of the Orange County Wine Society. And, you know, we would taste through the wines, and we would do our notes, and we would talk about it. And I, you know, really did become an expert. But she drove home when the meeting was over. I drove to the bar and closed the bar at 2 o'clock most of the time when those were over. One of the last times that I drank, and this is one of the ones that I talk about because it shows how ridiculous this idea of is. I can't possibly be an alcoholic because I only drink good wine. I only drink things that taste good. I'm a super taster. And so things that taste bad are I can't. And why would you? There are so many good things out there to drink. Why would you bother drinking things that taste bad? And I was still this Orange County nightclub bar drinker. And so there were plenty of things available, except at 4 a.m. At 4 a.m, there's a limited supply of things. And one of the last times before I got sober, I had been to Trader Joe's that day, and I had bought a case of really good expensive Bordeaux that was going to be laid down in the cellar. It wasn't going to be ready to drink for 10 years. And instead of going home and putting it away, I stopped by for happy hour at about 4:30 in the afternoon to meet some of my friends. I ended up leaving my car there. We went to a whole bunch of other clubs, and we ended up back at my car at like 4 a.m. And we still wanted something to drink. And I was with this lady. It wasn't even a guy this time. And we were trying to figure out what could I get to drink at 4 a.m. And I said, I know. I had a case of this Bordeaux in the back of my new car. And we didn't have a corkscrew, and it was in a wood case. And so I used the clean tire iron. Never, it's a brand new car, so it had never been used on anything. And I pried open the lid of this case of Bordeaux, tore off the foil, and then used the tire iron to push the cork down inside the bottle. And we sat in the back seat of my car in the parking lot of this nightclub in Orange County and drank this bottle of Bordeaux. That's the kind of drinking that I did. But when I checked into this spin dry program on February 24th, 1985, I said, I'm here for XYZ substance. And they said, well, by the way, you can't drink anymore either. And I said, I beg your pardon. You don't seem to understand. That is not why I'm here. And they said, nevertheless, you can't drink anymore either. And I said, well, damn, what am I going to do now? And I literally, this was my career. It was my future. I was really good. I was really talented. And all of a sudden, everything that I had planned for my future was wiped out. And I couldn't figure out what I was going to do with myself. I was very, very fortunate that night, the night before February 23rd. And this is the part of this, of page 151 of A Vision for You. These hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Bewilderment was probably my biggest one. I'm pretty bright. I'm pretty successful. I own a company. I have employees. I've always been, you know, very successful at whatever I turned my mind to doing. And that night on February 23rd, the day before my sobriety date, I could not think of one more thing to do. I couldn't think of one more, I know, I'll try. Every single thing I had ever tried to do to take away that horrible sense of those four headless horsemen, everything I had ever tried to make that feeling stop didn't work. I absolutely believe that alcoholics drink because alcohol treats alcoholism until it doesn't anymore, and then we're screwed. And that's what happened to me. I drank alcohol because it treated those first couple of drinks at that party he went to, and all of a sudden he was the handsomest guy on the thing. That night when I drank that bottle of Bacardi and that bottle of green creamed mint, all of a sudden, instead of being 5'10" and 95 pounds, with the boys saying, Liz, you're a perfect 36, 12, 12, 12. You know, all of a sudden, I was pretty. All of a sudden, I could talk. All of a sudden, I wasn't awkward. All of a sudden, I wasn't the red-haired, freckled, you know, brainiac bookworm that I had always been. And that's the way alcohol worked for me. I became cute. I became pretty. I became witty. I was always smart, but I wasn't witty. I was the like brainiac book nerd, never one of the cool kids. And like a little bit of alcohol and I would become one of the cool kids. And the other substances, by the way, never did that for me. I would try to be one of the cool kids with other substances and it never, ever, ever did that. Alcohol made me one of the cool kids. But as I checked into this spin dry program, because I was having consequences, I thought, because of this other stuff, I thought the other stuff was why I felt the hideous four horsemen. I literally had never one single time considered that I might want to quit drinking the next day and come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I talk about being struck sober. I had never one single time considered that I might want to come to AA the next day and never take another drink again. I had never considered that I was alcoholic. I thought alcoholism was what happened to my dad. My dad went to jail for 6 months in the 60s when no one went to jail. And the judge told my mom, Mrs. Seibert, I'm sending your husband to jail in an attempt to save his life. He's been in front of me now 5 times in the last 6 months, and he's going to die and kill someone else if I don't do this. So, you know, literally that's the kind of drunk that he was. He wrecked cars that other people were occupied over and over and over again. And I thought that that's what alcoholism was. and I had never been arrested. I had never gotten what then we called a 502. Now, that's not to say I'd never driven drunk. In the current day and age, I would have been arrested several times with roadside breathalyzers. But back in those days, you could fake your way through a roadside sobriety test. I do a lot of work with young ladies that are in a treatment program here in Modesto. And almost all of them check into that program with CPS cases. And they think that they have a drug problem. And they don't realize that they're alcoholic. And so we have AA altar calls there frequently as I explain what alcoholism is. And we were talking one time, we pick the girls up on Friday when we drive them out to our home group in Houston. And on Wednesdays, we actually take a women's big book study in there, our group does. And one day we were picking up some girls on a Friday night and we were driving out to Houston and I was talking and we talked about practicing saying the alphabet backwards. Non-alcoholics do not practice saying the alphabet backwards just in case they get stopped and then are able to do it. And she started laughing and she realized, oh my God, she had been practicing that for years. And like she left this women's home in Modesto as just a drug addict and arrived in Houston at our meeting as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like looking at those little kinds of things. Non-alcoholics don't practice saying the alphabet backwards. Well, I practiced all those roadside sobriety test things. And so I got pulled over 3 times during my drinking career and passed it 3 times and didn't get arrested. So, but in the current day and age, I would have. So sorry, I digressed there a little bit. So I check into this program on the morning of February. Let's go back to the night of February 23rd. I'm out at the bar with husband number two. We're at the end of the 29 months. And we had been trying to obtain some other substance and were not successful. And I got in a big fight with them. And we drove home and there was a bar. There was a little lounge right next to our apartment complex in Orange County. It was not one of the fancy nightclubs I went to regularly. It was just a little lounge right next to us. And we were in there and I had my last drink and I drank it down and I was mad at him. And he said, do you want another drink? And I said, no, I don't want another drink. And of course I wanted another drink, but I didn't want to sit there with him for another minute. And I stood up and I said, no, I don't want another drink. And I got out and I walked to our apartment. I was really pissed for the first couple of months sober because I realized that I had just turned down my last drink. And I was never going to go back and have a do-over on that. So I had turned down that last drink and I never did get to get it. And I walked home that night and I started crying and I was like bewildered. I was bewildered. I couldn't think of one more thing to try. I couldn't think. And I said what I believed to be the alcoholic prayer. Please God help me. There's the drunk prayer, which is God get me out of this and I'll never do it again. But the alcoholic prayer is please God help me. Please God help me. Now, mind you, I didn't believe in God. I didn't understand who or what God was. If there was a God, he certainly wasn't around taking care of me when I was being horrifically abused as a child by my mentally ill mother. By the way, that alcoholic father never one single time laid a hand on me. He was a great guy, absolutely great. Sadly, I was being raised by a seriously mentally ill mother with an absent alcoholic father. And so things were really terrible for me at that child time. But again, that is not why I'm an alcoholic. My sister had the same two parents. So there's this God and I don't believe in him. And if he is there, he's a son of a bitch because he didn't stop the things that he should have stopped. So it was much easier for me to believe that there was no such thing than to believe that there was one and he was a son of a bitch. That was just too difficult. So I'm praying to this thing, and I don't know that that's what I'm doing. I just know that I can't think of anything. And the thought came to me. I had what our book refers to as the moment of clarity. And I said, I think I need to go to a program. And I calmed down enough and started and fell asleep. And a couple of hours later, my soon to be second ex-husband came home and he said, and I told him, I said, I think I need to go to a program. And he said, I think that's a really good idea. And the miracle is that the next morning I got out the Yellow Pages and I looked up treatment centers and I found one and it was just a few blocks away. It said low cost and I didn't know in comparison to what. And I can tell you that this same book, this one I'm talking about here, $5,000, that's exactly how much that book cost. All the rest of y'all were, at that time in 1985, big books were $5. So I paid 1,000 times more than what the going rate for a big book was. And it's worth every penny of it, by the way, every penny. But I was very fortunate that the place it was a Sunday. They were open. I called them. I said, you know, can you help me? And they said, can you get somebody to drive you down here? And I turned to soon to be ex-husband number two and said, will you drive me down there? And he said, yes. And so he drove me down there and I started talking to this lady. And that's when she told me, by the way, you can't drink anymore either. And I said, I beg your pardon. And so that's when the next miracle happened, that I didn't just pick up and leave. Instead, so she looked over at soon to be ex-husband number two and she said, will you go home and get her some pajamas and a toothbrush? And he did. And he went home and packed me a little bag and he brought it back. And that day was February 24th, 1985, my sobriety date. And I've never had to take a drink since then. And the program that I went to happened to be one that believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was 28 days. In that 28 days, we went through step five. By the time I left there in 28 days, I had done a fourth step and a fifth step with a priest. It was a terrible fifth step. It was a surface and fearful, immoral inventory, but it was enough. It was enough to get me out of that program. And they told me that the people who went to a meeting on their own, the day that they got out, had a 50% better rate of relapse than people who didn't. And so, and when I got done with the 28 days, soon to be ex, I was still married to soon to be ex-husband number two, and he was still drinking. And so they told me that they thought it was a really the husband that was still drinking. And I'm like, well, I've got a job and they had given me a leave of absence and all of that. So I called my job and I said, can I have another 30 days? And I went to a women's recovery house and I stayed in that women's recovery house for another 38 days. And so at the end of 56 days, in the meantime, soon to be ex-husband number two had decided that he was alcoholic too. And he had joined Alcoholics Anonymous and he got sober and he stayed sober until he passed away. But we also realized that the only thing that had been keeping us together was our bar life. And that without that, we really didn't have a lot in common. He's a great guy. You will never hear me say anything negative about him. He kept me alive long enough to get to you. And you guys then saved my life. I don't think he saved me, but he did keep me alive long enough. He's one of those fellows that was going to make somebody a wonderful husband someday, just not me. And he did later remarry and he passed away several years ago. He had moved to Arizona, as far as I know, happy, joyous, and free. I'd left him alone. We were friends for quite a while after we got divorced. Then when I married husband number three, my ex-husband said, you know, I'm really uncomfortable with you being such good friends with your ex. So I stopped seeing him regularly. Anyway, that's a story for another Sunday. I'm trying to keep an eye on the time here. So then my career in Alcoholics Anonymous started. And let's do the arithmetic again. I was 27 when I got sober. I drank alcoholically from the time I was 19 until 27. So I drank about 8 years. And I've been sober for 35 years. So I've been sober for 4 times longer than the time that I drank. Most of my life has been spent in these rooms. More than half of my life has been, I was really barely an adult at 27 when I got here. And so I got to grow up and become an adult in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've gotten to do so many things. I've moved several times, and I know most of the people that I know that have really, really long-term sobriety, almost all of us have had the experience of moving from one area to another. I've been in California for my whole sobriety, but I moved in 1989. I was 4 years sober, and I moved from Orange County to San Luis Obispo County, to a little rural area in the north part of the county. And when we moved there in 1989, there were several AA groups. There was no central office. There was no intergroup. There was a hotline that several of the groups had kind of gotten together, and we all kind of contributed a little bit of money. And, you know, we passed around a sign-up sheet among the groups and made sure that somebody was answering the phone. But that was all we had at the time. And it was a big enough area. There were probably 40 groups in the area at that time. And so I got up with a group of other young people that we were full of piss and vinegar and didn't know how hard it would be. And we put together a 501c3 and formed an intergroup and did the incorporation and did all of that. And after about a year of having intergroup meetings without a central office, we were able to rent and staff and open a central office. And that central office is still open today on Higuera in San Luis Obispo. So if you go there and visit it, I am blessed to have been a part of the forming of that. And I stayed there for, I stayed in San Luis Obispo for 20 years. And during that time, I'm sorry, let me back up a little bit. I forgot about Boy Meets Girl on AA campus. When I was living in Orange County in 1986, I went to the Southern California Convention in October of 86 in San Diego, and there were 7,000 sober alcoholics there. And I run into the one that I ended up meeting and marrying. And he was 21 years older than me. And it was a really, really, really bad idea. And both of our sponsors told us it was a really, really, really bad idea. Both of our sponsors fired us, as a matter of fact. His grand sponsor was Johnny Harris. I heard Wayne talk about him. And everyone told us this was a terrible idea. But I'm like, no. We got this. I understand, and I know myself way better than you do, and the whole thing. And so I married him anyway. And I had 29 years of hell. But I do have to say that every single thing he ever did to me, he did in the year between when I met him and when we got married. And I married him anyway. So that's on me. That's not on him. I believe that in addition to suffering from alcoholism, I suffer from relationship addiction. And after 29 years married to him and living through absolute hell and all kinds of serious mental abuse, he was bipolar and he refused to take medication. And so it was terrible. I finally, and during that, most of that time, I hadn't had a sponsor. The one sponsor had fired us. We got married anyway. We moved to San Luis Obispo, and I did get Bernie, and Bernie was great. Bernie died in 1996. And I didn't get another sponsor until 2016. Ask me how that worked out. 20 years I walked around here unsupervised. 20 years I walked around here relying on my own knowledge. 20 years I walked around here not getting counsel with others. It's our book instructs us. It doesn't talk about sponsorship specifically, but over and over and over, it talks about wise counsel. It talks about it in step four. It talks about it that counsel with persons is often desirable. It talks about it in step nine, about that we talk to people before we make decisions that are going to affect, you know, other people. And I walked around here for 20 years without appropriate supervision. And it was terrible. I didn't drink because I had done the work and the 10th step promises had come true for me. So I didn't drink, but I had to go through all of that without anesthesia. It was just unbelievably painful. And I finally got a new sponsor in 2016. And she started telling me that I had to speak truth. And I started trying to do that. She didn't tell me to leave. She didn't tell me to get a divorce. She didn't tell me any of those things. But she did say, you have to speak truth. And so I started trying to do that at home. And it quickly became obvious that I couldn't speak truth and stay. I couldn't say, I will not allow you to speak to me this way. There was no way that I could do that. And in July of 2016, I finally did an intervention and said, you have to get some mental health help. You have to go back to the doctor. You have to go back on your medication. And I did an intervention with our pastor. And he said, no, that there was nothing wrong with him, that I was the problem. And I said, then I'm so sorry, but I have to go. And I did. And I haven't had any contact with him except through a lawyer since that time. And it was a huge breakthrough for me to realize that I didn't have to stay in the victimhood and the prison that I had created for myself. That the cage, one of the doors to the cage had been taken off years and years and years before. And I had been free to leave all that time. And for whatever reason, I didn't. And I don't need to beat myself for not doing it sooner. But I did finally understand that I was free to choose. I was free to choose a God of my own understanding. I was free to be able to walk through. And it was excruciating to walk through that in AA. It was excruciating to be one of the AA couples. It was excruciating to have both been scheduled to be on our local old timers panel, because at that time we both had over 30 years of sobriety. It was excruciating to be the founders of our home group in Houston, where we are now. And all of a sudden, it's like, what do you mean Liz is getting a divorce? What? It was terrible. And to have to walk through it and not throw him under the bus, to have to walk through it with grace and dignity, to have to walk through it and talk about my side of the street, to have to walk through that and talk about where my defects of character and my fear and my lack of reliance upon God and all of that. And speaker for a spaghetti dinner, which was a fundraiser for our upcoming Northern California conference. Modesto was going to be the host city that year in 2016. And I had been asked to be the guest speaker for the spaghetti fundraiser for the host committee. And I'd been asked to speak before I made the decision to leave. And the speaking engagement was 3 weeks after the date that I had separated. And I wanted to quit. I call my sponsor and I'm like, do I have to do this? Can I back out? Can somebody else please do this? And she's like, no, you have to show up and do it. And and then I said, well, do I have to wear a skirt? My toenails are terrible and I don't have any closed-toed shoes. She says, yes, you have to wear a skirt. And I showed up with my eyes red and puffy and from crying and it was just wretched. It was absolutely, I think, one of the worst talks ever. I didn't know what to say because I'd been talking quite a lot. You know, I'd been invited to speak and I had, you know, my little kind of set spiel. You know, and then we did this and then, you know, we moved and then, you know, we met and married and blah, 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 and et cetera. And I'm like, all of a sudden, there was no rhythm. There was no timing. There was no chronologically to my pitch. It was terrible. And after it was finally, thank God it was over. And a couple of people walked up to me, and one guy walked up to me and, you know, shook his hand, you know, the little line that they do after a speaker. And one guy says, wow, that was really raw. And I'm like, yeah, thanks. And like three people later was this woman who was crying and tears were rolling down her face. And she said, wow, that was really raw. The exact same words that the guy three guys before had said. And she meant something entirely different. What she meant was that my being willing to stand up there and share the pain that I was walking through, to share page 133, you know, that says, if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize on it as a way to demonstrate his omnipotence. And during that season, I went back to going to about 10 meetings a week. You know, I'm not a big one for sayings that aren't right out of our literature, but one of my favorite ones that I do say is, if grass falls off, put it in a bucket, bring it to a meeting, and we'll show you how to sit down without it. And so during that season, my ass had fallen off, and I picked it up, and I put it in a bucket, and I took it to about 10 meetings a week, and I had 31 years of sobriety. I was sponsoring several girls, and none of them fired me. And all of a sudden, I'm showing up at all kinds of meetings where I'd never shown up before. And a whole bunch more people asked me to sponsor them. And I'm looking at these ladies and I'm like, what is it about this literally walking bucket of snot do you see that's attractive? And to every one of them today will tell you that what they saw was me developing a relationship with God in the midst of pain and tragedy. And what they said was, I saw you with a relationship with God. I saw you walking through this with grace and dignity, not blaming anybody else, and developing your relationship with God as you walked through this. And like one of my gals, Amanda B, she just took 10 years. She just took her 10-year chip. And she was 6 years sober, and she hadn't had a sponsor in a while. And she was contemplating drinking. She was planning a drink. And I started showing up at the MCVPAW, which is our Mid-Central Valley Young People's. I am a young people, by the way. I was 27 when I got sober. Now I'm an oldie PAW. Oldie PAW are people who got sober before they were 30, and now they've been sober for 20 or more years, right? So I'm an oldie PAW. Anyway, so I was going to MCVPAW every Monday night, and because I wanted to be around young people that were alive and all the rest of that. And all these young girls started asking me to sponsor them. And I'm like, what? And Amanda said that I wanted the relationship with God that you have. And it has taken me a long, long, long time to develop that relationship with God. It's taken me a long, long time to develop it. We talk about this Alcoholics Anonymous in our book. One of my favorite pages is in We Agnostics. One of my favorite chapters is We Agnostics, but one of my favorite pages. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live. The purpose of the book is to enable, and I paid $5,000 for this book. I thought the purpose of that book was to teach me how not to drink. That is not the purpose of the book. The purpose of an AA group is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. That's the purpose of an AA group. But the purpose of the book was to introduce me to the power that could solve my problem. The solution to these terrible four horsemen, because I had these terrible four horsemen before I ever took a drink, before I ever ran into that accelerant. I had those four horsemen forever. I couldn't figure out how to live. I couldn't figure out how to get past those bedevilments that we read on page 52 by mistake. I couldn't figure that out. And Alcoholics Anonymous and the book and the directions in the book introduced me to the power, and the power solved my problem. I believe that alcoholism is trying to fill the God-shaped hole with anything other than God. I believe that every other form of abusive use of a substance. I'm not going to say addiction or whatever, but every other form of trying to eat, gamble, get in relationships, men, women, shopping, cars, money, job, work, food, whatever. It's all a method of trying to fill the God-shaped hole with something other than God. And whatever that is, there isn't enough, because it will never fill or fit in that God-shaped hole. It's this jigsaw puzzle piece, and only one piece fits in that hole. And that hole, that piece is God. Now, that's God as you understand him. I have a personal relationship with a very specific God, but your relationship does not have to be. What I do know is that that God that I have the relationship with now was not the son of a bitch. That he was, my two choices of either he doesn't exist or he's a son of a bitch. And I had preferred to choose he doesn't exist over the intolerable idea that he does exist and he chose to not stop what happened to me. I do not believe either of those things are true now. What I believe is that God wept while those things happened to me, and that he never wastes a hurt, and that he's been able to take every single thing that has ever, ever, ever happened to me on the way. One last thing that I need to fill in here is, and it looks like, how much time do I have, Mike? I still have about 2-3 minutes.
You're fine. Go ahead.
Okay. During the 1990s, I had decided, I was about 11 years sober when I decided that I wanted to be a mom. And ex-husband number two had gotten clipped a long, long, long time ago. He had had 5 children. They were all grown. He thought he was done with that. And I said, I changed my mind. I want to be a mom. And he agreed to go through the process. And so we started trying infertility treatments. And we did infertility treatments for 2.5 years. And we spent, at that time, about $20,000, which in today's dollars is probably $40,000. And at the end of 2.5 years, we had no money and no baby. And we were bankrupt. And I didn't understand. And all through that time, I'm sober. I'm sponsoring people. I'm doing H&I. I'm going into the women's jail. Because I never gotten arrested, I was able to go all the way into the women's jail, like all the way into the units and sit with the girls. And so I did a lot of that work. There were only 3 of us in the county that had that privilege. And I thought, okay, God, what you apparently want me to do instead of being a mom is you want me to sponsor women. You want me to, you know, go into the, you want me to do all these kinds of things. And I don't understand, but if that's what your will is, I'm willing to go along with it. And I stopped trying. And a year later, my phone rang. December of 97, my phone rang. My mom was on the phone. My dad was on the extension. She said, go get what's his name and sit down. And I said, okay, who died? And she said, Chris, that's my youngest sister. Chris is pregnant and she's 26 weeks and she wants to know if you'll take the baby. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Yes. Oh my God. Oh my God. My sister still had 2 more years to drink after that. She was 37 years old and she had decided too late that she wasn't going to have this baby. And she had drank and used all the way through. And Rachel was born February 26, 1998, 2 days after my 13-year sobriety birthday. And I got Rachel straight from the hospital and Chris disappeared. And I had Rachel declared abandoned and went through the process and we adopted her. And then I later discovered that Chris didn't show up because she was incarcerated at the time. She had ended up being arrested for manufacturing with a felony. And Chris ended up getting sober in jail. And she got out, and she's been sober now for 20 years. But in the meantime, we had already adopted Rachel, and I'm mom, and that's Auntie Chris. And Rachel knows all the truth, and there's a great relationship. But I have the most amazing daughter. She's 22 years old. She is developmentally disabled as a result of alcohol-related neurodevelopment disorder. She has fetal alcohol syndrome. And she's amazing. Not but, and she's amazing. She still lives at home with Robert and I. And we're looking at what's next in her chapter. It took her until she was 22 years old, but she got her high school diploma this last year. And she's just an amazing, amazing kid. And the whole point of that is that God's will is the thing that if I'm willing to like bend my will to God's will, the plan that he has planned for me is more amazing than anything that I could think of myself. During that 2.5 years when I was not pregnant and the news seemed to be filled every single night with another story of a baby that got put in the trash can at the prom or left in a garbage can. This was before the safe harbor laws that we have now. And it was heartbreaking. And I remember calling my daddy and saying, "Daddy, I don't understand why they have a baby and I don't." And he said, "Honey, I don't know either. I just don't know. I believe with every fiber of my being that God, as I understand him, knew that Rachel was coming. He knew that Rachel was going to need a mommy. And he knew that I was supposed to be her mommy. And if I had a newborn, Rachel might not be here. And can you imagine a world without Rachel?" So God's plan all along was better than anything I could have dreamt of. And I thought at the time that what I wanted was to push a baby out of my bottom. That's not what I wanted. What I wanted was to be a mommy. I didn't realize that what I wanted, God had been planning all along. And that's what I really wanted. Frankly, I didn't have that much desire to carry a baby. What I wanted was to be a mommy. And God made me the perfect mommy for that perfect child. And that's what my mommy used to say. My mom passed away last year, but she used to look at me and she used to look at Rachel when we were struggling through the really childhood and infancy is really, really, really hard for drug babies. And my mom would look at me as I loved Rachel through the next tantrum, through the next meltdown, through the next, she would have these like little mental, she would have what the big book refers to as a brainstorm, which is a violent mental fit of insanity. And she would have these and I would just hold her until they were over. And my mama would look at me and she would say, "God sure knew what he was doing when he made you the mother of that child." And so when I'm going through anything now that I'm struggling with, or I'm like, "God, I don't understand. I do not understand what you're doing today." It presupposes that there is in fact a plan and I don't have to understand that plan. I don't have to understand. And I don't even have to like it. God does not demand that I like it, because I did not like that 2.5 years. I am telling you right now, I did not. But I was willing to submit. And I was willing to pray in this way, "Thy will be done." And so I think we can ask God for what we want and say, "You know my heart," as long as we follow it up with, "Thy will be done." And so that's my prayer for everyone who's here today, is pray to God tonight when you go to bed. Say, "God, you know my heart. Thy will be done." Thanks. Thanks, Mike, for asking me.
Thank you. And I'll say thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank